59 degrees Racine, 64 Kenosha, 61 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Probably most commonly. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two interviews for you today. In part one, a newly recorded interview with the author of a book about creativity. In part two, from the archives, a conversation with Sasha Martin and her wonderful memoir called Life from Scratch, a memoir of food, family, and forgiveness. Here's part one. We're going to be spending part of today's program talking about one of the most essential elements of being a human being, and that is creativity, being creative. And we're going to be doing so with a gentleman by the name of Jonathan Fanning, who is a very well-known leadership expert, speaker, entrepreneur, and also the author of several different books, including I Once Was Lost and Who Are You Becoming? He has traveled across the country and overseas as well, speaking on various issues, and has also presented a TED Talk that was very, very well received. His most recent book is titled Creativity Unleashed, Five Habits of World-Class Innovators. And in this book, Jonathan Fanning explores kind of the nature of creativity, of what it is and how it can be fostered, and also talks in really intriguing fashion about how sometimes being boldly creative means being willing to fail, and how sometimes our most creative, innovative thinkers did a whole lot of failing, and in some cases were not even recognized for the geniuses they were until long after the fact. So there's a lot wrapped up in this intriguing topic. And once again, the book is titled Creativity Unleashed, Five Habits of World-Class Innovators. And Jonathan Fanning, we welcome you to the morning show.
Yeah, it's so good to be with you, Greg. And you hit the nail on the head. You know, it's creativity is a lid on life. You know, it's a lid on the impact that you and I have. It's an impact on our relationships, on our finances. Sometimes when you put the word creativity out there, people say, well, you know, art or music. But it's so much more than that. You know, it's will you start that business, or will you build that project, or will you change that relationship or alter the course of the way you or your kids or your community see the world? And yeah, it's such an amazing topic, especially for today, especially in a time of change.
Absolutely. I want to give you a chance to just talk for a moment, if you don't mind, about something that is mentioned just pretty much in passing in your biography, namely that you experienced a traumatic car accident at some point, kind of midway through your professional life. And and this car accident really seems to have had a powerful effect on you, and in some respects kind of altered the trajectory of your personal and professional lives. Tell us a little bit more about what happened to you and why it had the impact or effect on it that it did.
Sure. Yeah. You know, we all get wake-up calls. I like to call them frying pan moments. You know, it's like when something in life, something happens, and it's like getting hit over the head with the frying pan. And yeah, I was in a traumatic car accident and almost jumped off a bridge as a result. It was warm day, cold night, black ice. I think most people have experienced that. The car starts sliding on the highway, and then two tractor trailers plowed through my car. The second one hit my door. I watched it coming towards my door, and I'm sliding sideways, probably 60 miles an hour. And I look and I see this truck come straight at my door. I lean away, and my seat, my side of the car, didn't exist anymore after that. You know, but when I regain consciousness, the car's still on the highway, and I start kicking at the metal that's left, the fragments of metal that are left to get out of the car. I'm panicked. I don't know what's going on. When I get out of the car, I see that there's still traffic coming towards me, horns blaring, you know, and I start running to get out of the road, and there's this concrete guardrail, you know, 3-foot-high concrete guardrail on the side of the highway there, because it's a windy section of Interstate 80, western Pennsylvania. And I say, well, I'll jump the guardrail. I played basketball in college. I could jump a 3-foot guardrail pretty easily. I'm about to jump it, and I had this thought, don't jump it. I couldn't see what's on the other side. It was dark. So I grab the guardrail and swing my legs over, and then I find out that my feet are touching nothing. I'm on a bridge. I'm on a bridge near Clarion, Pennsylvania. It's about 106 feet between me and the ground. And that, you know, that'll wake you up. That'll wake you up. And, you know, after that accident, I started thinking, like, what are you doing? Like, you get a second chance. You could have been in the bottom of the gorge. That truck could have, if it hit the wrong angle, I wouldn't be here anymore. And that was one of the things that my first book, Who Are You Becoming, is really based on that experience, and saying, like, what kind of a person are you becoming? You know, are you more patient today than you were a year ago? Are you, you know, better with people? Do you care more about people? Are you more forgiving? Are you more focused? Do you have more courage in your life? Are you better at saying no to the distractions of life? And the same thing with creativity, with this journey of creativity. Because I think everybody has this seed of wanting something that's not where they are right now. You know, and it could be, you know, I'd love to have a better relationship with the people in my life. You know, or it could be, oh, I'd love to travel more. Or it could be, I'd love to help impact this in my community. Or you coach a sport. I'd love to be able to be a better soccer coach, you know. And creativity is a lid on all of that. And that accident was one of those frying pan moments, Greg, you know, where you go, all right, are you going to change something or not? Hmm. And I started really thinking about it.
So this is twice now you've used the word lid. LID, mm-hmm. Right? So explain, yes, exactly the way in which creativity can be a lid. And is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Sure. Yeah. No, it's a beautiful question. So a good friend of mine says to me one day, I get to speak all over the world and work with companies all over the world. And he said, Jonathan, it's great. You make an impact. And he said, I bet you could have 100 times the impact over the next 10 years that you've had in the last 10. And that, see, I mean, the questions we pursue is one of the most effective ways to change our creative potential. And that question just raised the lid on how I saw my role, on how I saw what I was trying to accomplish. So what I mean by lid is, if I'm trying to solve small problems, I tend to find some small answers. You know, a lot of people go into the weekend saying, what am I going to do this weekend? Well, I'm going to do this weekend what I did last weekend, right? I'm going to do, or I have no, but if I say, what's something I could do this weekend that has the potential to create a memory for my family that they might never forget, you know, and that raises the lid on what you're even looking for in that weekend. Years ago, I was speaking in Sydney, Australia, and long flight from New York to Sydney. I wake up when we land, exhausted, and I check into my hotel around noon, and I fall asleep. I thought, I'll take a quick nap. Well, the nap turned to be like a 12-hour nap, you know, and I wake up at midnight in Sydney, and I'm thinking, what do I do since I can't fall back asleep? And at first, my questions were, how do I fall back asleep? And then I thought, well, I'm not falling back asleep, so what can I do with the time? And I thought, well, I'll catch up on some emails. I'll finish working on that chapter I'm writing, or some proposals, or, you know, follow up on email, you know. And then I thought, that's lovely, but when we talk about a lid on our lives, I slowly changed the question, and I said, what could I do since I'm wide awake and I'm stuck, right? I'm stuck in Sydney, Australia, you know, in the wee hours of the morning. What could I do at this time that could be a memory that I'll never forget? And I thought, well, you know, that's a different question. I could go see the sunrise reflected off of the Sydney Opera House. You know, and sunrise that day, I think, was 5 a.m. And I'm thinking, like, we don't usually wake up in time to go see the sunrise at 5 a.m. Most people don't. But most people are not stuck in Sydney either and wide awake. And that's what I did, you know, and I'll never forget it. I'll never forget it. And that's, I hope that answers the question of how is it a lid? When we start changing the questions we pursue, it raises that lid and our experience of life, our impact in the world, all of that changes.
We're speaking with Jonathan Fanning, and we're talking about his latest book called Creativity Unleashed, Five Habits of World-Class Innovators. So your book begins I'm in an interesting way by talking about how, well, let me read the opening of your first full paragraph. We love creativity. We love innovators in the rear view mirror after it's worked, whatever the it happens to be. Tell us more about this and why you wanted to begin the book by talking about this.
Yeah, so a few months ago, my wife takes me to this museum, and it's one artist's work on display. We spent a couple hours in this gallery, and it was a classic starving artist, you know, an artist who sold one piece of artwork in his entire life, you know. And it's when you think about it, imagine if that's your brother-in-law, you know, in every family event. You're saying how's the art going, you know, and this artist happened to paint a completed work every day or so. So for 10 years, this artist made 2,000 completed works and sold one. Right? If that's your brother-in-law at Thanksgiving, you know, at the summer barbecue, at the Memorial Day, you're probably saying, is he still working on that? Should we not discuss that? You know, and even more, this artist would mail his finished paintings to his brother, and when he passed away and his brother passed away, his sister-in-law opens up crate after crate after crate after crate of paintings, you know, 2,000 of these. A lot of them had been re-gifted because he would give them away and people would say, yeah, I don't like that, let me give it away. You know, a lot of them had been destroyed. 100 years after he passes away, Vincent van Gogh, one of his paintings sells for $82.5 million, right? And the question it begs is, was he creative, Van Gogh? Was he successful? And if you and I were his brother-in-law or sister, would we be saying, yeah, he's doing some great stuff? You know, we love, Greg, we love creativity in the rearview mirror. We love it after it's worked. Steve right. Jobs gets 12 years of vacation from Apple. You know, they fired him. The board fired him in 1985 and finally brought him back in 97, 12 years later, because he was trying to do stuff that the world wasn't ready for. The company wasn't ready. He was really trying to build an iPhone in the early 1980s. He wanted the computer to be able to do video and audio editing, and he wanted to do stuff that just it wasn't possible. Well, he didn't think so. You know, we love it after it's worked. We love the creative person. Wow, I can't believe he did that. I can't believe she did that. But in the moment, we're a lot of times we run from it. You know, so I started the book with that because it's a hard question. Do you want more creativity in your life? Because some people, and even you, are going to be looking in the mirror saying, is this really a good idea?
Right. I love the quote you share with us from the great Mark Twain, who once said, a person with a new idea is a crank until the idea succeeds. And so often when we encounter people in our lives who push the envelope, push the boundaries in one way or another, it's not always something that is necessarily attractive. It might be. It kind of depends on how you're wired. But mm-hmm. when that out-of-the-ordinary idea becomes something really special, then suddenly that all looks a little bit different. So mm-hmm. the subtitle of your book makes reference to five habits of world-class innovators. So there are five aspects to creativity that you think are important for us to, first of all, be aware of, and I should think it's important to foster these five characteristics. Tell our listeners about these five pillars, which I think at one point in the book you call the blueprint.
Sure. Yeah. So the five things we saw over and over again, and it's hard to pull out things that creative people have in common, you know, because they're so creative, but they tend to ask, the five are ask, expect, collect, iterate, and the last one I call F4OB. It stands for fail, forward, fast, frequently, and if possible, do it off-Broadway. You know, F4, F7, and OB. And I say that because it takes doing a lot of things that will not work, but learning from them. It's you could call it fail and learn instead of just crash and burn. You know, the Wright brothers, for example, they flew over 1,000 tests before anyone was in their aircraft. You know, Wilbur writes to his father. He says, look, there's a lot to learn here, so we need to be crashing repeatedly, but don't worry, we're not doing anything risky. You know, most people don't think of creativity that way. They think it is risky. And Wilbur was saying, no, it's exactly the opposite. We're going to do a lot of experiments where dying is not the outcome, you know, but crashing is and learning is. You know, and so often that's the case. Go back to Vincent van Gogh. You look at his early works. Most of them were mediocre. His earliest paintings or drawings, a lot of them you say, okay, this guy's not very good at drawing sunflowers. You know, but it wasn't his first painting of sunflowers that the world knows about. It wasn't his first Starry Night painting that the world knows about. You know, and the Wright brothers, it wasn't their first crash. They started with little kites that they would tie to something on the ground. And then they'd put weights on them and try to figure out, can I steer this kite better? And, you know, how do I make the kite a little bit bigger? And how much weight can it lift? And so it's those five things. It's ask, expect, collect, iterate, and F4 will be fail. Those are the five that we saw over and over and over again.
And I suspect if people stop and think about it, they will understand what you're saying. But I'm going to have you spell out in terms of that fifth one, not being afraid to fail, that it's especially good if those failures happen off-Broadway. For the sake of someone who's not really acquainted with Broadway and off-Broadway, or maybe the way in which theater and musical theater operates, explain that concept of an off-Broadway failure.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Sure. So a lot of times we say, I'm going to try this, but I'm going to try it in the spotlight. You know, I'm going to try it when it matters. Martin Luther King Jr. gives this speech where he mentions having a dream, right? It was August 28, 1963, and he says, I have a dream that one day, right? And we know that speech. But Martin gave that little piece of that speech roughly 130 times with live audiences before that speech in Washington. And it wasn't as good the first 30, 60, 100 times as it was the 130th time, you know, August 28, 1963 at the lawn in front of the Lincoln Memorial. Failing off Broadway is about trying stuff that probably isn't going to be perfect. It's getting version one out there in a way that you learn something, but it doesn't sink the ship. You know, you don't end up bankrupt. You don't end up losing your relationship with your kids. It's a lot of times I get to do, I run an entrepreneur camp with high school kids. And so often I tell the kids, I said, you're better off having almost no budget for marketing when you start a business. And they tend to look at me like, you're crazy. And I said, no. You will experiment in ways and learn lessons that you might not ever do otherwise, because you have to try experiments that don't cost you anything. You know, they cost you some time, but they don't cost you. And we go through case studies, and we have a lot of guest entrepreneurs. And so often the guest entrepreneur will come and say, yeah, we spent $50,000 on marketing, and then we found a way that works that cost us just about nothing. Mm. You know, and the F4OB is about that. It's about how can I set up experiments where there's a ton of learning, but the cost is not, it doesn't sink the ship if it doesn't go well.
Right. A couple of specific points I want to touch on, and then there's an especially interesting story I want you to tell from the book. First, I want you to talk about something that you like to call the innovator's equation. And it has to do with a couple of different mathematical equations, and fortunately they're not, you know, so complicated that most of us can't readily understand them. One of them is 6 plus 4 equals blank. The other equation is blank plus blank equals 10. So again, 6 plus 4 equals blank, or blank plus blank equals 10. And I think what you're suggesting in your book is that some people sort of live their lives by the first equation, when in fact it makes more sense for us to live at least most of the time by that second equation. Explain the difference between them.
Sure. Yeah, most of us, we spend most of our lives on the 6 plus 4 equals what? You know, and the answer to that question is 10, right? We say, what's my budget look like? What does my resume look like? You know, what's the team I have? What are my numbers in the business world? What are my last year, my LY numbers? If you're selling a house, you go and you do comps. What are houses selling for that are similar size, similar neighborhood, similar conditions, similar kitchen? And we have this 6 plus 4, and we get a 10 as a result. And the most creative people on the planet tend to spend a little more time than most of us on the other equation. The other equation says blank plus blank equals 10. It says I'm trying to create something, some outcome, some result. What could possibly go into that equation that comes up with 10? Because the answer to that second, what I call the innovator's equation, is it doesn't matter what the first, if you put a 1 in there, 9 gets you the 10. 1 plus 9. If you put minus 1, minus 1 plus 11 gets you to 10. 0.1 plus 9.9. So the answer is there are infinite ways to get to 10. You know, and most of us, we say, wow, how much money do I have to do this? You know, how much vacation time do I have? I just had the chance to spend 2 weeks in Europe with my family. You know, and towards the end of the time, I said to my kids, I said, would it be amazing to do this more often? And they said, yes. And I said, well, how would it be possible to do this again in a few months? And they're looking at me like, are we going again? I said, no. The question is not, are we going again? The question is, how would it be possible to do this again? And it's going to that innovator's equation and saying, I would love to fit this into my life somehow, right? What do I need in the equation to get the answer? Let me put it one different way quickly. Walt Disney, for 10 years, would not discuss the question of how much might Disneyland cost to build. And he was unbelievably intentional with that. If people started bringing up the cost, he would stop the conversation, because he wanted to say, his question was, what do we want to build? What do we want to create? What would be unbelievable to give to the world? And then eventually we'll figure out what the blank plus blank, how do we get there? You know, most of us go straight to, well, what can we afford? And as a result, we end up building something that's not quite what we might have dreamed of. You know, not quite as amazing as building the first Disneyland.
I want to give you a chance to tell just one of many, many stories that are in here. That is a wide array of success stories of people who were willing to let their creativity fly, and in more ways than one. And of course, you know, among other things, you really tell the story of Orville and Wilbur Wright in really interesting fashion. And speaking of flight, you also talk in really interesting fashion about Amelia Earhart, and tell a lot of other really intriguing stories. I found myself really grateful for the time that you took talking about Starbucks. I did not remember all that was involved in sort of the launch of this now incredibly successful company. And I wonder if you could explain to our listeners the way in which the story of Starbucks is one of, among other things, exceptional creativity. Another way to think of it is creativity at its best.
Yeah, and Howard Schultz building Starbucks is an amazing example of that innovator's equation as well. So the founders of Starbucks, they're in business for about a decade when Howard Schultz gets involved, and he's a kid from New Jersey who goes out and visits them in Seattle, and he says, "Wow, this is really neat. I'd love to be involved." And he starts pestering them, and eventually they hire him to help them with marketing. And they only had a few locations. And by the way, this is early 1980s. They did not sell a cup of coffee then. That wasn't an option in Starbucks. You could buy beans or ground coffee. You could buy equipment to make your own coffee, but you could not walk out of there with a venti. You know, you could not walk out of there with a latte. And so Howard Schultz starts working with them. And on one of his trips to Italy, to Milan, Italy, he notices that this coffee culture of Italy is unbelievably appealing. There's a romanticism to it. There's a community side to it. And he just loves hanging out in these little coffee shops in Italy. You know, and he's not there to do that. He's there to look at machinery and equipment and different brewing and different coffee blends to see if, you know, Starbucks might want to bring some other equipment into their line. And he gets back and he says, we have to sell coffee to go and coffee to, for people to sit here and sip a latte and a cappuccino and a macchiato. And the founder said, no. You know, and he harassed them with an amazing passion and intensity over the course of more than a year. And he finally gets them to do a little experiment. And he says, like, let's just do one little coffee shop within one of our locations, you know, selling equipment and beans and coffee grinds. And they do it, and it does more revenue than they had ever done in a single day in their history. So you would think the founders would say, let's do this everywhere. But they don't. You know, so Howard goes out and blank plus blank equals 10, innovator's equation. He says, I want to create these kind of places. That's his 10. His 10 is not a 10, by the way. That's a big part of the innovator's equation is you can change the outcome of the equation. You can say, I don't want to create a 10. I want to create a 15 or a 20 or a 50 or a 100. And Howard says, I want to bring this amazing experience of the Italian coffee shops to the United States. So he goes and he starts looking for investors. And he doesn't have the money to do it. He doesn't have the ability to do it. He doesn't even know enough about coffee to do it. But he goes and he finds investors and he says, I'm going to set up my own little coffee place. And he calls it Il Giornale, which is the biggest newspaper in Italy, Il Giornale, the daily. And he buys his machines and his coffee from the founders of Starbucks to run these new little shops. You know, and then about a year and a half later, the founders of Starbucks said, you know, we're thinking about getting out of the business. And Howard says, I'm buying the company. And he doesn't have the money to do that either. But he goes and he starts looking for investors. And one of them happens to be a guy named Bill Gates Sr., who he was very well known in Seattle. His son was not as well known yet at the time. His son was starting to build Microsoft. And Bill Gates Sr. says, I love the idea. I'm in. And, you know, Howard Schultz essentially took this blank plus blank equals 10. He took this, I want to create that somewhere else. And he knew he needed to change some stuff, right? The four pillars we found were ask, expect, collect, and iterate. The collect and the iterate are collecting ideas and perspectives and options, and the iterate is to modify those. Howard saw this thing in Italy that he loved, and he knew that the American culture would want something slightly different. You know, he knew we wanted a bigger cup of coffee. We wouldn't sit there with this little tiny espresso prop, perhaps. So he said, we'll do a venti. Venti is the Italian word for 20. We'll do a 20-ounce cup of coffee for people, and we'll make it so they can leave if they want. You know, and he knew he needed to modify it some, but he took this innovator's equation of, I want to create something amazing. I don't have to have all the resources to do it. One of the people we interviewed, creativity is pursuit of opportunity without regard to resources currently controlled. And that's the innovator's equation. It's saying my daughter, my 17-year-old daughter, right, she says she's graduating high school in a couple months. And she says, how much does college cost? She's been asking this question for a year. And she says, it seems like it's $50,000 a year. And she starts asking this question. And she designed the cover of the book, by the way, partly because I wanted a creativity lesson for her to see that she could do something that most people don't think they can do yet. You know, she designed it when she was 16. Huh. But she starts asking this question, how can I get somebody to pay me $50,000 a year to learn instead of paying someone else $50,000 a year to learn? And that's the innovator's equation. You know, that's the, I'm looking for a different outcome. I don't know how to get there yet, but I'm willing to start looking. I'm willing to start looking for options that might fit into that.
Right.
That's Howard Schultz's story. Yep.
And in so many ways, this book is about asking the right questions, and in particular, to ask maybe new and uncommon questions or uncommonly asked questions. At one point, you quote Albert Einstein. You say when he was asked if he had 1 hour to solve a difficult problem, how would he do it? And his response, I would spend the first 55 minutes figuring out what questions to ask and the last 5 minutes asking and answering those questions. Really, really intriguing stuff. In our closing couple of minutes, we are talking today about creativity in a world in which this thing called AI or artificial intelligence has been unleashed. And it is something that, of course, is maybe in some ways calling into question the nature of creativity, the value of creativity, especially human creativity, in this landscape in which AI exists and is being utilized more and more. How should we be thinking about our own creativity? And how do you see creativity itself maybe functioning differently, if you do, in a world with AI?
That's a beautiful question, and that's a challenging question and a half. AI is definitely, it's already changing the world, and it's not going to stop changing the world. So one of the most amazing gifts that we have is our ability to choose the question. The first pillar we found in this research was ask. They tend to do what Einstein said. They tend to say, what's the real problem I'm trying to solve here? You know, what's the quest I'm on? What are the questions I'm really trying to answer? And in the world of AI, for us to use it as an amazing tool, we give it great questions. It can help us come up with options for how to solve that. You know, how to solve that question. We give it bad questions. We give it mediocre questions. We give it yesterday questions or survival or non-survival questions. And it tends to go and solve those problems. You know, we give it a question of, all right, give me a way to get from here to here. Give me options of how to get from here to here using this amount of fuel or energy, right? And it starts solving those problems. You know, but we give it a different question. How do I make this trip and make it a lot of fun? Different question, right? How do I start an article? How do I write an email? You know, I have some people that I work with in leadership roles, and I give them the challenge to go into AI like it's an advisor to you, like it's one of the best advice givers you can have. But ask it questions that are worth asking. You know, like, how can I cut the number of emails my company sends in half? You know, and it's this question that we give the tool of AI, a question that we actually want to pursue. You know, in the world of inspiration, for example, is a story I tell in the book that Amelia Earhart, when she was 7 years old, her father borrows money from his father-in-law to take a trip to see the World's Fair. And this is 1904. This is when it's hard to do this kind of thing. This is when 300 miles of travel requires several trains and several overnight stays, and they do it. And his two daughters, Amelia and Muriel, come home inspired beyond belief. You know, Amelia gets home at the age of 7, and she has her uncle help her build a roller coaster from the roof of the house to the ground. And she said, you know, I crashed on the first run, but it felt a lot like I was flying. And her the way she saw the world never went back to before that trip. And it begs this question, what's the return on investment for inspiration? You know, and see, Amelia Earhart's father used the tool of a World's Fair to facilitate inspiration in his family. And we can use the tool of AI to facilitate amazing as well. We have to be careful what questions we ask, of course, but that's every tool, right? That's every tool.
The book again is Creativity Unleashed, 5 Habits of World-Class Innovators, and its author, Jonathan Fanning. Thank you for this, and best wishes to you.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD, FM 91.1, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview from The Morning Show Archives. I hold in my hands an absolutely beautiful, even mesmerizing memoir called Life from Scratch, a memoir of food, family, and forgiveness, written by a woman by the name of Sasha Martin, and you perhaps know her from an extraordinary adventure of sorts which she undertook, which was encapsulated in a website you can still visit called Global Table Adventure, in which she, for her family, cooked a different recipe from essentially every country on the face of the earth. And when one visits that website, you can see many of the recipes which she used and blog accounts about some of those culinary adventures, if you will. Well, now we hear, in a sense, the story behind that story in this wonderful memoir called Life from Scratch, in which we not only find out a little bit more about what prompted Sasha Martin to undertake that journey of extraordinary discovery, but the story behind her early life and the way in which, in a sense, the ground was laid for her to want to explore this as she has. And I'm so excited to be able to speak with Sasha Martin for the next few minutes about her memoir, Life from Scratch, which has just been published by National Geographic. Sasha Martin, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be on with you today, Greg.
I think a lot of people may be surprised if they know something about your website and this wonderful adventure that you've undertaken, that when we pick up the memoir, the story is about quite a bit more than that. I know I, for one, was really surprised, but I loved the book, so I ultimately was very pleasantly surprised. As you sat about writing your own story, were you surprised as well that, in a sense, so much of the backstory became front and center?
This was not the book I meant to write. It was very early on in the writing process that my editor challenged me. She said, "Sasha, it's not a normal thing to be cooking a meal from every country in the world, A to Z, for 4 years." And she pushed me, you know, because I had a pretty happy-go-lucky outline going for my first draft of the book. And so I went back. She, you know, sent me away to have some self-reflection, and I kept going back to my childhood and this, you know, trying to figure out what this yearning for belonging, where that was coming from. And the challenges that I went through as a child were such a force in my life. So in and out of foster homes, struggling with poverty, things like that, that I knew I couldn't write about my hunger for peace and cooking the world if I didn't first make peace with my past. Mm. And so that's, the book did grow, and it became this enormous undertaking that I never expected to get into so
right.
soon.
It's a marvelous book, one of the best memoirs I think I've ever read. We should say right off the bat that your mother was a very, very intriguing, gifted woman who loved you very much, but a very unconventional parent. And at one point, she was, in a sense, compelled to give you up to the foster care system. Just briefly say a word about sort of the events which precipitated that drastic move, that drastic decision on her part.
Well, you know, there's a lot of things going on, but definitely, like as you said, she was unconventional, and it was the kind of thing where, you know, if my brother and her got in a fight and it was the middle of the night and it was freezing cold out and he stormed outside in his pajamas and he sat on the curb pouting barefoot and there's snow outside, she would let him and she would say, "He'll come back in when he cools off." You know, it was kind of that free-range parenting before it became the buzzword of today. And, you know, social services would drive by, and that was the kind of thing that just didn't fly. And
we should maybe mention that you're... We should mention that your mother also was a single mother for most of your childhood, and so she is struggling in sometimes unconventional ways to just put food on the table and provide some kind of a life for you and your brother. And evidently a few of the choices she made might not have been the optimal choices, shall we say.
Yeah, I mean, there was a challenging time, and you know, I think when you are under that sort of pressure financially, and you don't have somebody you can go to, you know, a partner that you trust and love that will help balance out all those emotions. She was just, there was a lot on her shoulders, and so over time it became more and more challenging, and by the time I was 10 years old, she did end up requesting that somebody take care of my brother and me. And so it ended up being old family friends of hers, which it was sort of a gift that you know, that connection was possible.
Right.
To complete strangers.
Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is you write at one point, there's a difference between poverty of resources and poverty of spirit. For a long time, Michael, that's your brother and I, were oblivious to hardship because of Mom's determined efforts. So in a sense, one of the gifts she gave you was her own resourcefulness as she tried to cobble together interesting meals with next to no money to be able to spend on ingredients. And I suppose maybe that's one way in which she has served as an inspiration to you all these years later.
Absolutely. My favorite recipe of hers is the German tree cake she made for us when I was a little kid, you know, a rainy day activity. It's sort of an outrageous cake, 19 layers. There's no reason to make a cake that complicated, but I don't know, it was just the sort of fantastical thing that she would bring into our lives and give us that sense of playfulness and fun no matter what. I mean, my brother and I were sleeping in the living room. We didn't have a bedroom, and so that kitchen was that central place that pulled us together where anything could happen, and that was a real gift.
Right. Well, ultimately, as you said, you and your brother are given over to this couple, Pierre and Patricia, who care for you very attentively, and ultimately his a change in his work takes you to Paris and then to Luxembourg and onto quite an adventure. But one of the most intriguing things about your life with them is that Patricia did not want you in the kitchen, and that was so foreign to you, having been in the kitchen all the time with your own mother. And it sounds like that also was a way in which you came to understand and more deeply appreciate what that had meant for you and what it means for you now to be in the kitchen cooking food for family and friends, having been excluded from that for a while.
Yeah, and that was extremely difficult. And I will say that as a young girl, I think we often don't know how to voice what we need, especially, you know, I'm living with this new family and I mean, there's just so many challenges, and so I didn't speak up. I didn't say what I was missing, and so instead I survived like we all do. So I went out into the streets of Paris and Luxembourg, and I went to the boulangerie and the creperie and the fromagerie, and I got my culinary education that way, but it was always sort of this restlessness. You know, they provided this tremendous education. They definitely provided my wanderlust that it inspired this adventure, right? I went to 12 countries by the age of 19, thanks to their generosity and the experiences I had through living with them. But yeah, in terms of the food, it almost became a little bit of a holy grail for me because it was forbidden. And so finding ways to kind of sneak it into my life, right, as a teenager was the thing.
I think one of the most touching moments in the book is when you talk about how Patricia, your foster mother, went back to the United States to care for her own father, and you and your foster father, Pierre, had to, in a sense, kind of forge a new life in which suddenly you found yourself in the kitchen, welcome in the kitchen, and one of the first times you made a real meal for your good friend Annie and your dad, and you thanked him when it was all done, and you said, thank you. Suddenly tears were in my eyes. I don't think you'll ever realize what this means to me. It was one of my happiest high school experiences, building friendship while sharing the joy of communal dining and creation. I mean, probably not until that moment did you realize what a beautiful thing it is simply to be in the kitchen cooking for family and friends.
That's right. That was a tremendous experience. And I think you're right. When things are gone from our lives and we get them back again, they just shine so much more brilliantly, I think.
Right.
And so, yeah, that was a tremendous experience. And also to be so young and to have these dinner parties and be able to, I mean, I made pasta from scratch. I didn't just have friends over and make, you know, macaroni and cheese. We're rolling pasta out on the table. I mean, I just went nuts because it was like somebody who'd been starving who gets to eat again. And so I did the most complicated thing I could possibly do for that age, right? Mm-hmm. It was pretty awesome.
Well, you write so beautifully about all of these various experiences, I mean, with your family and the difficulties and your own personal resurgence, and fast forward now to being married to your husband and with your young daughter embarking on this amazing adventure of cooking recipes essentially from every country on earth. And you recount much of that, and some of the recipes are actually in this book, Life from Scratch. As you did that, through literally hundreds of recipes from nearly 200 countries around the world, how often did you end up cooking something that you sort of regretted versus versus the recipes where you were so glad that you were sitting down and eating this wonderful meal from Botswana or wherever it might have been? I mean, very often did you find yourself regretting certain specific choices?
Oh, my gosh. Well, almost never, to be honest. I mean, there were definitely times that were very, very challenging. There's a time in the book that's recounted where with Angola, I made a huge mistake in how I prepared this dish called beton de manioc. And it's basically cassava. Some people call it yuca or manioc. You grate the cassava into banana leaf packets and you steam it. And it sounds simple enough. There were a lot of special directions, like soak the cassava and steam for hours and hours. And I thought, wow, that's a lot of, you know, that's a lot of trouble. I wonder why it has to cook so long. But I did what they said, thinking they know best. Well, what I missed from the instructions was that the sort of tough, fibery center of the cassava should not be grated into the packet. And this can have trace amounts of cyanide. And so they didn't tell, you know, I didn't have this information, but nobody in my family was interested in trying this dish. I mean, I think they all took one bite, and then I'm looking at these packets that I spent all day grating and steaming. And so in an act of frustration, I ate a whole bunch to prove a point. And I got really sick that night. And they'd say that the cassava that's in the United States has been treated so that it doesn't have any traces of cyanide anymore. But I'm not sure I believe that after what I experienced. It was pretty rough.
Fortunately, that was a very exceptional experience. And for the most part, it was an extraordinarily joyous experience and adventure for you and your very picky eater of a husband, Keith, and your young daughter, Ava. You say at one point, before she was five, she had eaten the entire world. And I love how you say that this adventure has really helped all of you, in a sense, understand the world. It's made the world, in a sense, a smaller and friendlier place for you.
Yeah, that's right. It was a joyous experience and a delicious one. And I think it's just, it's the idea of getting to know your global neighbors, right? I just, there were so many countries that we know so little about. So we hear about Chinese food, we hear about French food, and we have millions of cookbooks and stories about these places, but there's so many hidden gems around the world that I more and more as I went along on this adventure, I became determined to just celebrate every country equally. And I think part of that goes back to my mom's struggles that I write about in the first part of the book, because we're all, no matter where we're from, trying to just do the best we can for our family. We're trying to put food on the table, and so many of these countries become known for their one issue. And I think that does a disservice to the millions of people that are really sort of apart from that issue, and they're just trying to come together in community, just like my mom did with us. And so it was a real pleasure to share those recipes. And now I have people from those smaller countries writing me and saying, thank you for celebrating my country's food. It's such an honor. You did a nice job. Sometimes they send corrections, which are good too. But it's just such a fun thing.
Mm-hmm. The book is Life from Scratch, a memoir of food, family, and forgiveness, published by National Geographic. And you can also visit her website, globaltableadventure.com, where you can read more about this undertaking and order from her a free starter guide if you would like to know a little bit more about how you might do this for yourself and your family and friends. Sasha Martin, thank you so much for writing such a compelling book and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Best wishes to you.
Thank you so much, Greg. It was an honor to be with you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you'll be hearing a conversation that I recorded yesterday with Nate Stamper. He is the head of theater at Case High School, and the director of the current production at the Racine Theatre Guild. A very intriguing coming-of-age story called Stargirl. We'll talk about it tomorrow. And on Friday, wonderful writer by the name of David Coggins, the author of a book called The Believer, A Year in the Fly Fishing Life.